Welcome everyone to the third episode of the Lion-Faced Guru podcast. With me sitting here today are longtime yogic practitioners Kim Katami from Finland and Carla Akram from Norway. They're both teachers in the lineage of Pemako Buddhism, while Kim is also the founder of this Western lineage of Tantric Buddhism. I'm Mugi Müller from Switzerland, and today we're going to talk about the important topic of awakening and its universal place on the non-dual path. Paradoxically, awakening is the most talked about aspect of the spiritual path, and at the same time, the most misunderstood one. So this episode is all about demystifying non-dual awakening and presenting a clear and concise overview of the universal mechanics that reliably lead a person to awakening, whether they follow a particular spiritual tradition or not. As in the previous episodes of the Lion-Faced Guru podcast, we will both talk about our own personal experiences with awakening, as well as the theoretical, practical, and societal aspects and issues around awakening in general. And I would like to start to ask Kim about your personal awakening experience and what stayed with you from it, how you experienced it, what was most memorable of it, and how it is still alive in you today.
My pleasure. I think I spoke about this at length in the previous episode, on episode 2, but just to repeat some of the key points of that is that I had been doing a lot of traditional practices before I experienced my first awakening, first shift. Like I had done tons of practice, 8.5 years of continuous retreat. And so my personal experience, what it was that, I had been reading a lot of books about awakening and about Dharma, about from different traditions, from different teachers and masters, and they all spoke about this. And yet, and I knew that it's an answer that I was looking for, but I hadn't had the answer, hadn't experienced it myself, so I wanted it. And then when it finally happened through a tantric practice, then it gave me faith and confidence in teachings. In one way, it gave me confidence in teachings and confidence in myself that this basic nature or nature of mind, it's possible to actually, the word grasp is frowned by practitioners, but it's kind of taking hold of it. It's like you're getting hold of it because you're experiencing and living it afterwards. Your mind changes. So, me-based, I-based, reacting, constant reacting, just is very different after that first shift. So that gave me a lot of confidence, but it also, made me ask a lot of questions because, I had done a lot of traditional practice and it didn't happen. So many hours, thousands of hours of practice. So that also happened, that questioning, but the experience was, it was a change, of course. I started seeing things differently, my life differently. Yeah, it was something that I had been looking for a long time. Maybe I'll just leave it at that. You guys can take it from there.
Beautiful. What about you, Carl? You had a little different history, of course, than Kim.
Yeah, different, but at the same time, similar. So I've also talked about this before, so I'm not going to go into super detailed accounts, but I had also been looking for awakening for many years before it actually happened. So I think what triggered the search for me properly was a particular experience with psychedelic mushrooms. So that kind of shook up my worldview at the time. I was very much, and still am, so, but I was very much into like biology and the physical world. I wouldn't maybe say that I was a materialist through and through, but I'd never experienced like properly the energy body and those aspects of like beyond the physical. At least not, I hadn't had an experience that I actually recognized that something was different. So I had that experience, and then after that, I was kind of trying to figure it out. It left me a little bit weird afterward. So I was looking in various directions until I came across Eckhart Tolle's Power of Now, The Power of Now, a few months later. And just by reading the word spiritual awakening on the front cover, I recognized that, oh, there is something that I need to go in that direction. I was also introduced to Hatha Yoga, which fortunately was, well, you could say a more traditional, not the westernized version, with lots of focus on the physical. There was also focus on breathing techniques, pranayama, concentration-based meditation practices. So I kind of got into that, and also using a little bit of mantras. But over the years that followed, so I was constantly looking. I had my Hatha Yoga practice, and that was very much like a practice that worked for me at the time, because I was very restless, so it was difficult for me to actually sit down without having anything to do. So it worked for me as like a preparatory practice, but I kept on searching in various different traditions, and I also took a bachelor's degree in philosophy, which was primarily because I was trying to figure out what the hell happened, what did I experience. And probably, I don't mean to be dramatic, but those were probably some of the worst years of my life. Not that it was bad in any way, but it was just this constant, I have to figure out this thing. And why, like I was reading all like classics like Tao Te Ching, Avadhuta Gita, and lots of different books, reading lots of blogs by spiritual writers. And there was something I could understand, but mostly I got pissed off because I didn't really, as you mentioned, grasp it. I couldn't relate it to an actual experience or to at least not to a satisfactory point, in my own opinion, at that time. So at the same time, I wanted, of course, to be perceived as a spiritual person, investing so much time in this. So that was there was all this effort in trying to be a spiritual person. And without having the experiential basis, that took the form that I was trying to make an outer appearance. Ooh. Of.
Ooh.
It's a classic. Drinking tea, for example, and you know, stay away from the coffee, or trying to. So this constant kind of struggle of, it's just effort, trying to be in the present moment, and so on. So when I actually came across like going a few, so it lasted, I think, from that initial experience and until I found two-part formula, I think it was about 5 years. So I came across a two-part formula online, a blog post on a yoga forum. I was actually looking at, a place where I could become like a full-time spiritual practitioner, like a monk style. I wasn't sure which tradition or anything, but I was just, I have to dedicate, I have to renounce the world, and it has to happen now. But then I came across this blog, a forum post written by Yukim that stated that awakening isn't an accident anymore. Immediately caught my attention, and I started reading Awake ebook, and I felt that this is it. This is exactly the same that I had read in Eckhart Tolle's books and also various other teachers who I could just feel actually had some, there was some juice there to what they were saying. So I undertook the guidance, started I think the 5th of January 2016, and then on the 10th of January 2016, there was that breakthrough. And of course, first and foremost for me, when it happened, was just this relief that finally it could, like, because of course there was doubt that will it ever happen to me? Maybe there is something about me that makes it so that awakening won't happen in this lifetime. Or that I don't have, or that I didn't have the time to put in, and blah, 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 all of these worries. So there was, first and foremost, this.
That's a common worry that, you know, whether I'm fit in this lifetime to have this amazing, exalted awakening experience. That's really common. Many people have that.
Yeah. And those people who I had been introduced to previously, like Eckhart Tolle, and these, they seemed so, like, when they talk, they seemed so different in a way that they kind of seemed like just the calmest people. There was this, yeah. It's just very different from how I perceived myself, and so that added to that worry that, oh, these people, they're much better. They had a better starting point
right.
than I did. So immediately there was this sense of relief. There was this, you mentioned this, like, finally there is something graspable about, like, now I also get at least some parts of what is mentioned. So there was this inner shift where seeking was reduced. I knew that, okay, now if I just continue integrating this, then it'll be fine. Like, I also have the potential of further integrating and awakening. And I think that's it. Those are the most important points, I think, of my experience.
How about yours, Ubi?
That's a beautiful story, Carl. Didn't know a few things about it. Very, very nice. For me, I started with the 18 years old. I got into self-help and finally found at least the possibility that I can change myself, which was the glimmer of hope for my frustrated teenage years, because I didn't feel good about myself. Even though I had great parents, had good friends, I was going to high school, heading towards university, everything was pretty much fine around that, but something was missing. I had this sense of fundamental deficiency in me. I just felt flawed. And through the self-help industry, I kind of just tried so many different things. And then I came to meditation at one point, mindfulness, and started to do some of that. But it was always, please give me now this quick fix so that I can finally be whole again, or can finally be whole, even though that was also somehow unimaginable for me, because it just felt so real. This deficiency in me felt so real. And whenever I sat down and just kind of was with me, I really had the feeling that this is basic layer of my being, is this flawedness, this deficiency in me. And then I had a more or less a teacher who taught me a little bit more about mindfulness, and I had a few glimpses of how it is to not be focused on these stories for a moment. Just not following thoughts about deficiency around all the time, but just basic shamatha meditation. And that was first time I think I realized that, aha, wow, there is at least an alternative to not focus on that stuff. I still had the feeling it's there, but I could kind of focus on something else, on the breath or whatever, and not be occupied with it, which brought me kind of a relief. But then I got also through that teacher in contact with non-duality for the first time, and of course my antennas for the quick fix lighted up, and okay, this is it. Now I just have to read Who Am I by Ramana Maharshi, the little book, and this will make it. I just ask myself, who am I? And then all this suffering will be gone. Turned out a little bit more difficult, because I kind of was puzzled by the book and by the technique of self-inquiry. Even though I started to kind of practice a little bit of it, and also looked into other teachers that were around at this time, Rupert Spira, Greg Good, Scott Killaby, and I just tried to gather Adyashanti, all inputs I could to make this practice of self-inquiry and awakening something more graspable for me. That's the word again, because it was so mysterious. They talked about grace, they talked about it's determined to happen whenever it will happen. You don't really have control. Then there were all these teachers who said, you can do nothing. There's no one who does anything in the first place. And I was just kind of being boiled in this spiritual non-dual scene. Until I found out about Sokchen and Mahamudra in a book, and thought, okay, this is something different. While in the self-inquiry, it's more like you're on yourself and you ask your questions. And I had the idea at one moment it just pops, because you keep asking yourself that question and you have no clue what you're doing, and somehow it will pop at one moment. Whatever it was, I didn't know if this is full enlightenment, what awakening is, what happens afterwards. It was one big puzzle.
I have something about that. I never read that, or I might have read like some text by Ramana Maharishi, but I don't remember, like, how does he explain the process and the technique?
Process of self-inquiry on Ramana Maharishi is actually, you ask yourself, who am I? And then you get a thought like, I'm the body. And then you ask, where does this thought come from? And then you stay, you try to localize the place in stillness, and you try to stay there. You try to abide as that stillness where the thought comes from. And when another thought comes again, you counter it with, who am I? You counter every thought that comes up with the question, who am I? Get an answer on that question, and then you ask, where does that thought come from?
Mm-hmm.
Where does the I thought come from? So you basically go, the way to actually do it is go back to stillness, to thought-free stillness.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
at least how I practiced it and understood it. There are many people who thought it's actually only asking yourself this question all the time, like an affirmation, who am I? Who am I? People who did that sometimes for 40 years.
Wow.
Very dedicated every day. And they just had this idea that it's all about just asking that question again and again and again for hours.
Well, I was of that impression when I didn't actually read the works of Ramana Maharshi, but what I perceived at least to be people who had practiced the method. But the way I understood it was to ask the question, and then the thought comes up, you clear, like you see that that's not it, and then you ask the question again, and then something else comes up, and then you kind of trace it back to. But when I did practice that for a short while, because as you said, I was also like going to all the teachers I could find, but I didn't understand anything of what I was doing, just like you mentioned. But sorry, just keep.
All right, yeah. These are very good points. And I think many viewers will find that very, very relatable, because it's, I don't think much has changed since then in the non-dual scene. And this has been 5-6 years now. In the time of internet, it's a long time without change. Or at least some paradigm shift of information. But in this regard, it's still as mysterious as it is. As I can observe it, I still look at some of these teachers I followed, and I still am in forums, and I see what people are dealing with when they come in contact with non-duality, and it's the same stuff like I went through. Yeah, then with Dzogchen and Mahamudra, that was more this pointing style, which I thought, okay, that sounds somehow easier or more relatable. They seem to know a little bit more about what they're talking about when they speak about the teacher points you to it and then you see it. So that was a relief on my quest, on my seeking a little bit. I read all these pith instructions I could find from Longchenpa, Padmasambhava, and all the Rinpoches I could find, so googling up and down, pointing out instructions, and I read they're actually given in secrecy, and I was like, every time, yeah, I found another one, but someone wrote it down, and this didn't really bear fruit as well, because that's not the point of the pointing out instructions, to mentalize about them. But out of this, I googled and found I googled for space gazing, actually, space gazing and Dzogchen, and I came across a blog post of you, Kim, from the old Open Heart blog, where you gathered and collected some instructions on space gazing, which I think is Ati Yoga, just another name used by some teachers. And was like, oh, cool, yeah, finally someone from the West, someone who talks openly about it, someone who's who seems to know what he's talking about. And it was at this time that I found the Guidance to Awakening and the two-part formula. And there was no doubt about it that I will going to through this guidance. And I contacted Kim, and it took, I think, around 2 weeks. I tried it myself first for a little while, and then I went into the guidance for a few days, and it popped. So now the big question is what popped. We already had accounts from Carl and Kim. For me, it was extremely significant and not so significant at the same time. Extremely significant was it was the end of the seeking mind, and this was extremely significant for me. Carl talked about relief. That was it also for me. It was just in this moment when I. Some people don't experience this one moment of seeing through, of when the cherry pops. But it was for me, I was doing the two-part formula to awakening. And in this one moment, I just lost interest or the urge to do something about it, to find out. I lost the urge to find out. It was just in this moment, my focus went into empty space, into complete non-identification, actually, in this moment. Mm. And I just read my report I sent to Kim a while back. That was in 2016. I read that little report a few days ago. And what I described there, and this now from my further practice with Pemaco, I understand it much better. What was the difference to some spiritual states I experienced beforehand? I had some expanded states before, like when I did some meditation or some open awareness techniques, open shamatha, I felt like, I'm so big, I'm so expanded, I'm very connected to everything. Yeah. And this was, of course, very impressive, but it didn't last. And with this shift, it was not a state of expansiveness. It was not a state at all that I experienced. What dropped in this moment, it came back in a certain way, which we will talk about, but what dropped in that moment was the need to identify with anything. So that dropped. The identifier dropped. It was not about, now I'm the all. I am God consciousness or whatever. The identifier, that urge to contain experience, that dropped. And that was impressive.
Yeah, beautiful. And that's actually a good... This is a very technical way of saying it, but Buddha Dharma, Buddhism is really specific about what awakening or awakening experiences, what's the flavor of them, right? These grand states or exalted states, Buddhists instantly say that, okay, that's something else than awakening. And there's a good way to kind of a technical way to define or study, and this is kind of a classical Buddhist pointer that, in terms of three-dimensionality and zero-dimensionality, which is something that I sometimes talk, that when you have an authentic awakening experience, there's no this, and there's nothing, there's no this either, there's no this. It's just plain zero dimensionality. So you don't grow in size or expand in size three-dimensionally. You don't become big, or you don't come to experience oneness that embraces or includes everything. It's rather a state of a zero, like a plus minus zero, and that's the relief.
Yeah, like relief. I think it has those two aspects, because one of the ways I meant that it was a relief was that, okay, now I don't have to try so hard anymore. But then there's this second, more profound, more basic, that it's just a, like you say, zero dimensionality, which is quite technical and probably hard to relate to. But instead of this, like I also had these glimpses and these exalted mind states, but when they happened, there was always this slight kind of, it's not going to last. It's not like there is some, this isn't, yeah, this isn't going, like there, this isn't going to last. But after awakening, one of the things was that everything was just so natural about it. Just, no exaltedness to it, just everything that, so zero dimensionality, one way you could say it's just very effortless, natural, and also soft. So all sounds, for example, I remember going to the toilet right afterwards, and both the wind and the sound of the toilet was just so completely natural, the experience, and rich. Yeah. So just that point, that very natural, intimate relationship to whatever phenomena takes place.
And my two cents on that is that, you know, I had a lot of samadhi states. I had a lot of samadhi states, which means like a stage of one-pointed concentration, so that you become immersed or absorbed with this process of concentration, and your mind goes completely free of thought. So I had a lot of that, and I also had mystical experiences, you know, really, really impressive ones, you know. But also a test for, you know, and then I had awakening experiences in plural. So it was also like a what I experienced was that, you know, when I stopped sitting experiencing samadhis or had some mystical experience, and when I stood up and you know, started going about my daily life, and all of a sudden there's, you know, I had two cats. So when there's cat puke on the floor, or, you know, something completely ordinary happened, you know, it was like my mind state from that mystical or, you know, samadhi state was so, it was kind of far away. It was, there was an instant conflict, like an instant mismatch between those things that weren't it. But then with awakening experiences, recognition of the natural state, having emptiness inside, it was completely the opposite. It was a perfect match. There was no separation, no distance from this heavenly state to that cat puke that happened on this completely ordinary world. It was just, you know, meeting ground.
Yeah, so there is no it to oppose anything. It doesn't oppose any experience whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly.
And this was huge for me. I was freed from the sense of deficiency, because once you have this certitude, this certainty about that, this I you took yourself to be is might be appearing, but it's not real. It has no existence, no solidity to it. This just wiped that away forever since then. I think certainty is a big word and a very important word in Dzogchen and in non-dual Buddhism, because it's about this certainty that you gain. This, the attainment itself is actually a kind of certainty. It's a kind of knowledge, and it's a living knowledge that you have. Then it's not an insight that you can capture as a memory in your head and like, yeah, that was my awakening experience and that was it. It's a living certainty that changes. It's just, it switches on something, or something switches off the belief. Actually, that's probably better. The belief in the separate self behind the eyes, it switches off. You see that this was just a belief. You believe that this was certain, but now you are certain that this was just belief. And this certainty is what I think is also a very important part about awakening, because the certainty is completely in yourself. No teacher can give you that certainty.
Yeah,
it's the first time you might really gain a personal certainty about something without having to consultate a teacher of any kind, because you just feel it. And so this brings you back to yourself in a sense that no knowledge, no learning can give you.
In my experience, before that, all knowledge was like relative, like facts about the world, like mental, something that, intellectual way of understanding the world. But as you say, like this was the first, it's just a shift of perspective. So it includes everything that is perceived is then included because it's a shift of perspective. Just a short point there.
Mm-hmm.
And something that Ugi mentioned about that certainty is that a teacher can give it to you, but also there's a point that when you have it, when you have awakened, nobody outside of you can deny it. Nobody can take it away from you. And that's a really important point, because even if Guru Padmasambhava came to you or me or anybody who's had awakening and said that, you know, kind of tried to take it away from you, or somebody else would try to deny it from you, you know, it wouldn't work, because you have that subjective experience that, you know, gives you clarity, gives you confidence, gives you certainty about it. So it doesn't matter what other people say. And this is kind of an interesting thing about internal practice or spiritual practice, Dharma practice, that you have to verify any practice or any path through your own experience. Because it's only then when you know whether it's authentic and real or not. Because we practice because we want answers. We start seeking. So we seek, we seek, we seek. There's a search, but that search comes to a stop with awakening, because it's me or self that seeks. And when that self disappears or lessens gradually with awakening experiences, you know, then you know. But until that point, you don't have certainty.
There's a funny story from Sen I can't remember his name. I think that maybe you know it, Kim. The Sen poet who was kind of a rebel, visiting brothels and drinking a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a traditional. Anyways, I can't remember his name, but there's a story of when he awakened, it was actually verified. So he got a diploma from his monastery and teacher, and what he did was that he immediately burned it. It had no value to him whatsoever, because he already knew that as an experience.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of paradoxically, the Dharma is all about realizing selflessness, but the way into it is coming back into your own authority about your experience.
Yeah.
And I think many people mistake that on the Buddhist path, they give all authority to their Lama. Like all their conclusions, all their experiences are in constant doubt. They are not trusted. Everything relies on the Lama. And this is not this. It's all about gaining certainty in your experience. And the Mahasiddhas were always clear on that it's all about that in the end, that the teacher cannot give you that. Yeah, that was what changed for me, even though I also have to say that right after the awakening, after that moment, a day after, the urge to seek was gone, but there were thoughts of doubt around in my head, and that these thoughts were still there, and like, did it really happen? This just to underline that how much I was unprepared for what awakening actually is. You cannot form an image out of it before you actually experience it, because the only image you can form out of it is some kind of new identity, because you come from this self perspective, which can only imagine in identity mode. Yeah. And so you experience oneness or whatever, you imagine oneness or anything. And this is a very important point, that awakening is not about content of awareness. It's not about, it's about context. It's how Carl called it. It's a shift of perspective, not a shift of perception.
But did you, so I've described the period afterwards as like a honeymoon experience. How did you experience that? Did it, because you mentioned that already the next day doubt came into the picture. So was it like a very short period of clarity? I mean, of like greater clarity before you, maybe you could talk about after awakening.
Very good. I mean, I was probably still am a very mental person, and always that doubting thing was going on a lot. So it was no wonder that it came back so quickly. But it was not as serious. It really that one cannot underestimate that shift. The thoughts may be there. They may even make you emotionally react like. But it's just not the same thing anymore. There is something missing, a very crucial part of it. I definitely didn't have as much of a honeymoon experience after awakening as many other did. But what I noticed is that my vision was bigger, broader, and it stayed like that. Like my eyes could see more peripherally. Everything was definitely sharper. But I didn't have a concrete honeymoon experience. And yeah, I was just very, very satisfied with this gun seeking. That was the main point for me, that this existential seeking for wholeness, that this was gone. But it's a very good point about honeymoon, because I didn't experience so much of that sharpness or enhanced perception.
Some people have it, some people don't. Like in my own case, the effect of awakening lasted as a really steady clarity for about a year and 3 months. So like 15 months. And I had done a lot of practice before that. So, you know, there's this whole discussion about dry insight and wet insight. And mine was wet because I had, you know, wetted the ground or soil for 8.5 years before the first shift. And dry insight would be like a person wakes up, has an awakening experience without much prior or any prior practice. That would be called dry. And dry insight would be like it doesn't last as long, that clarity, and that Carl used the word honeymoon. So some people have it, some don't, but I think that, you know, my view is that the sooner anyone can awaken, the better. Because whether it's dry or wet, just pop that, shoot the dictator down, you know, that's always the best. Yeah, I don't think there's a good reason to, you know, do some calming down or concentration practice and then, you know, do some Vipassana practice like the two-part formula. I don't think there's a proper reason for that. So just get it done as quickly as possible is my advice.
Yeah. The reason I ask is that I also experienced it didn't last very long. It was very rich for a short time, so that I could see quite well what had happened, what the change was. But at the same time, the afflictive stuff, emotions and thoughts came back very quickly, maybe within 2-3 days, with some doubt. Like I thought that this was going to be much bigger than what it feels like now. But retrospectively, I'm really happy that it came back, because then it forces you to deal with it, to continue the practice of insight and not get stuck in this. So while we've all mentioned that it was an important shift, but by no means the end of practice. Mm. So in retrospect, very happy about the afflictive emotions.
Yeah, and also like, you know, I think that it depends who you ask, but I often ask this question from Dharma teachers and Dharma practitioners, including practitioners who are very experienced, like decades of practice, and you get different answers depending who you ask. But I've asked that, you know, what do you think is the, you know, when do you think you become a practitioner or become a Buddhist? And people answer this in different ways. Some think that when you take refuge and you start wearing robes, or when you take bodhisattva vows, then you become a practitioner or a Buddhist. But to me, the answer is always like when you experience awakening. Because, you know, that's obviously how, you know, that's how you come to know yourself. That's the first bite. And that's how the whole Buddhist tradition started, with Shakyamuni Buddha's awakening. So that's how I'm looking at it. Even though, you know, there are people who stumble upon awakening by accident, and like Eckhart Tolle, I was just listening to his own description of, you know, his own awakening. So, you know, you could argue that, you know, that first shift didn't, you know, if you listen to Eckhart Tolle today, you find some similarities with Buddha Dharma, you know, Buddhist teachings on the nature of mind, but you also find differences. So it takes people to different places, but it is also like that within Buddhism. So it's not all Buddhist traditions and teachers and lineages are saying the same thing. So anyway, this is kind of speculation, but I think that the beginning of the Buddhist path is awakening. However you
I would fully agree with that. That's my view as well. But also in general, awakening to the spiritual path is the start. Awakening is the start of the spiritual path in general, because before that, it's only relative. Like, you might have glimpses, but that's when you actually start integrating.
And a kind of something that came to my mind now, just talking about it, is that I kind of hate to say that it has to be related to a spiritual or religious system or a path like Buddhism or Hinduism or any other. I kind of don't like it, because it's a universal human problem and it's a universal human solution. So, you know, I don't blame people who might recognize that problem and they prefer not to become involved with Buddhism or any other ism, and they just prefer to stick with Western psychology, for example. I don't blame them at all. And so I certainly wish that it was without those labels, that it somehow could be refreshed so that the whole baggage of, you know, religion and isms wouldn't follow.
Yeah, I think that's kind of happening with the Western non-duality movement, which is trying to emancipate from the traditions, but with the disadvantage of it is, at least how it has been done so far, is it has become a do-it-yourself spirituality. People pick out from the traditions what they want to, what they feel like at this very moment, and they throw out the baby with the bathwater. By that, there's definitely much sense in this universality, this idea of perennial philosophy of that this is a universal human thing, this awakening and this liberation. But you cannot completely disregard the traditions, because that's what has been done. And they threw out all the models of awakening. They threw out so much universal truth actually away because they thought, yeah, that's Buddhism, that's Hinduism, that's Taoism, that's Kabbalah. And they just, only because it was framed in a certain language, these teachers didn't find that interesting and thought that's just cultural and religious. And they threw out all these very important further instructions and manuals and mappings of the spiritual path, so that we have this mess today. Carl mentioned the word mess before we started this podcast, and it is. Mm. So we have this mystified mess of non-dual spirituality today.
Yeah, and something about that path map. You know, if you're on a journey, you need a map. Because if you don't have a map and you're, you know, on a journey, you're traveling, you know, where will you end? You know, you can end up, you know, you can have all kinds of ideas where you want to end up. You can have all kinds of dreams and fantasies where you want to go and what you want to attain. But if you have if you don't have a map, if you don't have a clear understanding where you're going, what you're doing, if you don't have a clear understanding of the obstacles that might be on the path, that's not going to work. It's like a human being without a spine. You know, you can't have that. Yeah. So path maps are definitely very, very important. But also you know, at the moment in the West, you know, Buddhism and Hinduism, let's say Asian spirituality, is like in its baby stages. So there's still a lot of Asian influence from Tibet, from whatever country. And I think it's a bit difficult and very, very challenging situation to get to lose the, you know, we don't need the Asian cultural baggage or influence. Maybe we can learn something from it, but we don't need it because we have a culture of our own, a language of our own. So it's a difficult situation and very challenging one to translate to, what is the word, crop the essential things and lose the rest, which in other words means that, you know, how can we just take what Buddha Dharma is, what Dharma is, and leave the rest?
Something to add on the necessity of maps on my path. What happened 2 years after awakening, I got interest again in, okay, now I would like to start a spiritual practice. I would like to deepen that. And I actually started to do 1 year of daily, quite dedicated self-inquiry again, Ramana Maharshi style with a teacher. But I didn't know that I was trying to generate awakening again. I mean, I used a method that is for generating awakening, and I worked with that. And I didn't have a clue what I was doing in this moment. And I spent a year doing that. There were many beautiful moments. I discovered more and more of this thought-free state and samadhi state, which I haven't previously. So I discovered what Kim had discovered before awakening. I discovered after awakening samadhi and how blissful and beautiful it is. But I was so lost in that, and I tried, okay, this is the way, but why is there not more information? Just to keep doing inquiry. Whenever I addressed my teacher about it, okay, I feel like stuck, or I feel like there's a discrepancy between the samadhi states and everyday life when the thoughts are there. Of course, it was much easier for me to do these practices because I already had attained awakening before, but still I was just going in circles. For this year, I pretty much went in circle until I started to trust again myself and say, okay, I'm really stuck and this teacher cannot bring me further here. And then I remembered Kim and Pemaco Buddhism again. And within a few days, within one email exchange, I think with Kim, my confusion was gone because he just made me aware of the mappings. and made me aware that there are traps, and made me aware that there are misconceptions, and made me aware that there is one I'm currently in. And so then I started to really practice. So that's just about MAPS and what they did for me. And I was fortunate to only lose 1 year in this sense.
Oh, yeah.
But it's really weird how, because in classical accounts from very different traditions, there are MAPS, but somehow they're not used at the present moment. So that my experience has been whenever attending a teaching, so I usually want to ask very concrete questions to get some knowledge of, or in, like to get some idea of how they're doing things there, to compare to how I have been taught. And it seems like the question is always, don't worry about that, or don't worry about awakening, or just keep doing the practice. And it just never made sense to me when, like, I know there are some movements, for example, like the pragmatic, the pragmatic Dharma movement as a whole, I guess, that use path maps and have success with it, but that's the only one that I can think of that actually use these things, and it just doesn't make sense to me at all. Mm-hmm. As you say, wherever you're going, it's useful to have a map. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so obvious.
Something that I would like to add about that path maps, because I said that we're on a journey and we need path maps on a journey. And one kind of an abuse of Advaita or Dzogchen teachings is to say that, no, we are not on a journey. And therefore, no, we don't need a map. And, you know, we don't need these awakening experiences. It's kind of an abuse this view. What do you think? What do you guys think about that?
I think that's the main problem that's going on in the so-called, well, some people's interpretations of radical Dzogchen, and I guess also particularly Advaita, that it's like a denial of the relative, which has been warned against by all Dzogchen masters. Longchenpa says it directly in Basic Space of Phenomena, that a master has never denied the relative aspects of the human condition. Yeah. And I think it just grounds in this misunderstanding of instant awakening versus gradual, being put up as a dichotomy, like two opposites, when it really isn't, in my experience, that Dzogchen is about repeating the direct experience over and over, and that is what drives the progress. Until there is nothing more to do at all, which when the Dzogchen view is actually realized, or the non-dual experience is fully realized.
What do you think about that, Ugi?
I think it goes into the same direction as Carl says. First of all, there's some of these teachers have accidental awakening, and that's how it starts for them. And they therefore conclude retrospectively that there's nothing you can do about it. Like Tony Parsons is an example. He's like the neo-Advaita guy. Not using pronouns and stuff, the full non-dual speech that he's pulling off. He meditated for decades, and then he realized that there is no self. And then he said, "Yeah, all this practice was useless. It didn't generate anything. There was no one there in the first place who does practice." And and so this conclusion out of the inside, the knowledge that appears or that is activated with awakening, often turns into a denial of like Carl said, of the relative, and also about then of course of practice. When there is no doer, there's also no doership, so no one can do anything. And it's a complete misunderstanding. And what also plays a role into that, I guess, is they want to, or many people want to declare a fixed point. So this is it. When you've seen that there is no I, that's the end of everything. There's no further insight after that.
There's a very similar problem as well that sometimes happens. So you mentioned that, okay, awakening is the end. But then there is it's similar, but it's slightly different, that awakening is the only kind of permanent thing or only definitive point. And then there's endless integration that you can never be finished. It will always be deeper and deeper and deeper, which it's similar, and it also has similar effects in that you will get stuck because it's a direct result of lack of overview, lack of listening to the people who have actually gone the whole way before. Mm.
And one thing that, it's kind of a, you know, we are practitioners and teachers of pragmatic dharma, which again, you know, we have discussed pragmatic dharma in the previous episodes, and there's a whole bunch of writings about it in the Open Heart blog. But, you know, pragmatic dharma means that we are actually using our common sense. You know, and, you know, all these different fixed, you know, perspectives that are immature, yet fixed. I find it kind of strange that people buy into those things because it doesn't make sense. Like, it doesn't make sense in the light of everyday life, you know, everyday routines. It just doesn't make sense in the relative world. So kind of strikes me how people buy into that stuff. To me, it always has to make sense to be, you know, before I'm even interested, it has to make sense.
Another thing I think also kind of influential on the modern non-duality scene is that the two main figures, Ramana Maharshi and Nisargadatta Maharaj, they were kind of rebellious, I think. Ramana Maharshi was not a strict Advaita practitioner. He woke up by himself, deepened, had his samadhi period for years after that, and then went to open his ashram and was just present there and then staying on the sofa and walking up Arunachala. And Nisargadatta had a teacher, but he's always said, the teacher gave me only one thing, focus on the sense of I am, this is your practice. And he did that day at night until he awoke, and then he started teaching. But these two, I think, most prominent founding figures of the Western non-duality movement, they themselves didn't use mappings already. And they are there like the saints of non-duality. They are like the real deal. and everyone is referring back to them. And so there's just not much foundation you can build on if these are your cornerstones.
So I think we discussed, you know, one of our topics is that why is awakening regarded as such a mystery? You know, I think that lack of maps and lack of clear understanding, lack of context, and lack of exact techniques makes it a vague and mystical and poorly defined thing. So should we discuss the technical side?
Yeah, as we know, we have Kim Katami here who found such a technique. You brought this such a technique into the public awareness, the two-part formula to awakening. Mm. It's been around for quite some years now. Mm. What is very important to mention is that you kind of held statistics about people who used it, at least the ones you are aware of who used it and gave report of the shift that happened. Mm. And there are around 200 people or probably over it already who awakened through using the two-part formula. Mm. As we did, as Carl and I did. So talking about the technical side of things, what's the technical mechanism of the two-part formula which generates awakening?
So one very essential word that you already used is the word mechanical. Mechanical. It has nothing to do with beliefs or magic formulas. It's a mechanical technique, and mechanism means that you understand how something works, you understand a mechanism of something, you understand the components. So that's how the two-part formula that uses two mind modes of being, modes of mind that, I would say every person, every human being experience on daily basis. It uses the, let's say, selfless or calm, clear mode that is first established in the body-mind, felt, recognized through experience of the body-mind. And then the mechanism is that, we have this sense of I, me, coming up, happening every day in our life, from moment to moment. So it is stubbornly and consistently brought back, this sense of me, sense of I, this so-called subject self. Like this, that type of self that is, that, when we, in our everyday life, when we speak that I went there, I think that, I don't feel that way, that I, what does that very ordinarily thought and expressed I, where does it point to? So it's that I, that sense of self, sense of meanness that is brought back again and again and again to be seen over this selfless, clear mind. Same like a classical analogy that if you have a movie screen, white movie screen, the white fabric, and then you have images on it. So it's the selfless mode that is the movie screen, and then the I thought, me thought, mine thought is brought back against it so that we can become aware of this subject self, the I thought. And so speaking about the mechanism of it, I have a friend and student who's the leader of our Irish Sangha in Dublin, Ireland, Jonathan, who gave me a wonderful feedback after his awakening. And he said that, he had been practicing 20 years of classical Buddhist meditations, 20 years in a really committed and devoted way, and he hadn't awakened. And he gave the feedback after his awakening through the two-part formula is that, he had been looking outwards for thoughts, for emotional states, like he had been looking down into the body. What is happening in the body? How does it feel in the body? How do these emotions come up and affect in the body? And he had been only practicing Vipassana meditation regarding these so-called object selves. So regarding thoughts and emotions. But it had never once he had received an instruction, or it hadn't occurred to him to, you know, bring the attention back to where he's looking from, to the source of looking, where the subject self is sitting. So, and that's, you know, that's when he did, he got awakened, because he went to the source of awareness, source of his problem in terms of dukkha, existential confusion. So that's the mechanism of it. And this is really common. So it's an issue we have been talking, and Carl mentioned the word mess, that the spiritual scene or the Buddhist Dharma scene is kind of a mess because there's no standard, right? And it's kind of a problem that there isn't, you know, people, even practitioners, they accidentally stumble upon awakening or awakening experiences. But that is not a standard, because it's more or less random. So it's not like a rule standard that produces a certain result. And a lot of traditions say that, a lot of famous teachers say that, you know, there aren't techniques that directly generate awakening. And this has convinced a lot of people. People take it automatically that, okay, so there aren't techniques that produce awakening, so therefore I will just tell like my teacher tells me, just keep going, just keep doing your practice. That might be relevant or might be completely irrelevant in terms of generating awakening, generating genuine insight. And this is my experience, you know. I practiced for many years in retreat. I practiced techniques that were almost entirely irrelevant in terms of awakening. So it's a big problem, I think, that there are many teachers out there, you know, really highly regarded teachers who say that there is no technique to generate awakening. But this is, you know, they might be speaking, and they are speaking as presenters of their own lineage and their own tradition. But by all means, they cannot speak on behalf of all Buddhism. You know, it's just, you know, so this should be questioned. And so in Pemaco practice, in Pemaco Buddhism, we use this two-part formula. But historically, very similar or almost identical techniques have been known in Tibet, in Mahamudra and Chogchen traditions for centuries. But they have been kept secret, just within small lineages. So with the two-part formula, it's just openly shared in the internet. Yeah, there really isn't more to say about that. You know, it just does the trick. It does the job, just like a hammer does. You know, like as a completely simple tool. You know, if you have a hammer, you can hit the nail on the wall. So it's really as simple as that. And yes, I kept statistics for the first, I actually still have statistics. I haven't given guidances myself in about a year and a half, I think, because I did it about 150 times. I kind of got fed up with answering the same questions and clarifying the same points, so I'm taking a break. But I kept statistics throughout all my guidances that I've given. And so the very first 100 cases, guidances that I gave, 98 out of the 100 got awakened. And those two who didn't were really early on among the first 10 guidances that I did. And I just didn't have enough enough understanding myself as a teacher, as an instructor, to help people to use it. So it was kind of my own fault. But, you know, after those first 10, everybody has gotten awakened. Until, is it 148 cases now in my statistics? So it's basically everyone, except those who give up, because there are a couple of, like a handful of people who have started guidance, but they, for one reason or the other, they haven't followed through it. So, but my bottom line is that it's a mechanical technique. And because it is, it doesn't, there's no question marks or any vagueness to it. It does the job and that's it.
The way I've always viewed it, and which is basically what you said now, but that whether, so the reason two-part formula works mechanically is that it is actually the mechanics of awakening in textual instructions. Right. So whether you have like Eckhart Tolle or whoever had like a spontaneous awakening, if you look at what they say, it's the same experience. It's the same mechanism that happened there. It's disidentification, and then they went straight to the source. Like, does that, is that clear what I mean by that, by those words?
No.
Like, this identification from the subject, IA, recognizing the basic clarity and then viewing the central knot of I, the problem, just like you described there.
Yeah, it's it works like a charm, exactly, because it is so mechanical, and you don't have, you cannot go astray with that, with such clear instructions, and there is no room for misconceptions, as is with the traditional self-inquiry. There are so many misconceptions, and you can so much go astray. As is this idea, like, yeah, stillness is your true self, also go always back to stillness. If you always go back to stillness, you just practice shamatha and you rest in the substrate consciousness. But there is no penetrating inside, and the I feeling remains unaffected. It's just bypassed. And this is, that's just these two modes where this cannot happen, because you take everything into account, really the not and the unboundedness, the not and the unboundedness, the not, and then you just contrast that and let them merge, and then you see, aha, the knot is nothing else but unboundedness, unbounded clarity, and then it just pops. But if you follow this traditional, there are many people who awaken through self-inquiry, Ramana Maharshi style, of course, but there are many more who don't. That's why, Kim, probably why you named one of your first texts about awakening, Awakening is Not an Accident Anymore, because it's kind of alarming when the ones who really get it are the accident, the exception of the rule of a technique.
And I gotta say that, you know, I published my first renditions of the Awake book over 6 years ago. You know, I gave the instruction of the two-part formula over 6 years ago in the internet, and you know, the Pemaco team has been consistent ever since in you know, publishing materials related to the two-part formula ever since. But I gotta say that it's much, much harder to get it out there than I expected it to be. It's very, very hard, because, you know, people are so convinced that, you know, we have discussed during this podcast that, you know, there are misconceptions wrong views about the path. You know, some deny the awakenings, you know, some spend hours in whatever kind of samadhi or oneness states, and then there are, you know, like I mentioned just moments ago, that there are teachers who say that there are not techniques that generate it, and therefore, you know, people who read about the two-part formula, they're saying that, oh, that's nonsense. That's complete nonsense, because this Rinpoche or this Roshi or this whoever said that there is no technique for that. So it's a real pity. And I have sometimes even thought of the karmic consequences of saying such things, because like teachers who have said it, because, you know, it affects so many people, hundreds, thousands of people, and they basically learn a wrong view, and it does a disservice for them. So I don't know what else can I say, like, on top of all the podcasts and talks and books and blog posts I've done, but maybe I'll just say that, you know, if you, those who listen to this podcast, now that you've heard us talk about the two-part formula, keep your common sense and study it before brushing it off as nonsense. Especially if you haven't had the experience before, you know.
Yeah, I think many people are surprised after awakening of the reception, and or when wanting to spread, because it's something wonderful that the natural,
yeah,
at least for many people, the natural instinct that comes about is that, oh, I know other people looking for the same, and I know people who possibly are not looking, but they're still struggling with the basic existential confusion. And there's this natural, like, you want to get the word out, you want to help others, and then usually there is this wall. And the wall is obviously not based on common sense, as you mentioned. So it's, for me, and I know that also for you, it has been a frustrating experience to be met with this wall of nonsense in many ways.
That's the mess. That's the mess again.
That's the mess again, yeah. And it also reminds me of something that you said the other day. I think you wrote it somewhere, that it has been difficult to accept that it's also based on people's readiness for the instructions to actually go through with it.
Mm.
But I think that's a very important point. And it might be controversial to say that there is this method, or we have this method, you will benefit from it, but if you don't recognize that it's valid, it's because you're not ready. But I think that's actually very close to the truth. Just throwing some...
But I actually remember, like, I used to teach, or school here in Finland, I used to teach meditation instructors. And these were courses, like, this was many years ago. And these were courses that, you know, any people could join. These meditation instructor courses. So these people, over a span of a year, they became, I schooled them to be meditation instructors. And some of these people, like, if we use a traditional Buddhist description, they didn't have merit. They weren't ready to non-dualist, the whole discussion or experience of non-dualism. So they only had like a mindfulness, like mindfulness-based stress reduction background or something like this, something very secular. So they didn't have that burning seeking happening. They weren't looking for answers. But nevertheless, I had them do the two-part formula, and it worked.
Mm.
nevertheless, you know, I just had them, I told them to practice it, and it worked.
That's an interesting point then. It will work nevertheless, but it will take, or it's less chance to actually encounter it and apply it. And I should say that there is also nothing, because I think the controversial point of saying about readiness is that it seems like we or you have come up with a solution that will, that is just the best solution. But it's not that. It's just that it's in being the mechanics of awakening in a instructional form, it will work for anyone. And like when I was looking at it from like before actually applying it, it just made instant sense based on like my very scattered previous experience.
Yeah.
This is a really curious thing, this wall of resistance that that comes up if you mention that there is a methodology to generate awakening. It's a really, really curious topic. I see many reasons why that is happening. Of course, there are all these concepts that are now ingrained in the spiritual mind of the West, like everything happens in its own time. It's kind of predetermined. It happens by grace. It kind of strikes you when it's the right moment, which is pretty much some idea of fatalism, of determinism, that you cannot do anything. It's predetermined. You can bullshit yourself longer if you move around in conceptualizations like that. And there are very, very curious reasons going on why people back off from actually awakening. And I think this also comes back to one point that Yukim mentioned in the first place. We have the belief that probably deep down in us that we are not the ones to awaken. Who am I to to make a significant spiritual discovery? And so we back off. We are hesitant actually to techniques that work, because that challenges that self-image of unworthiness. Or I just go to listen to Eckhart Tolle, pay my $120, sit in the hall, and he is so peaceful. But there is not that spark of I want that, and I can get that.
Yeah, I think, again, it's this looking outwards that is the problem. Failing to recognize that we're actually talking about the nature of all beings' minds rather than some beings' minds or people of a certain country's nature of minds and so on. So I think it stems from this. And even if the spark is there, like for me, the spark was strong in that I really wanted it. It was just that it took a while to find the method. But it didn't lack of effort, of seeking in that sense. But it was just always seeking outside.
Well, that's kind of the same problem that I was when I said that, you know, it's a universal Buddha Dharma is about universal problems. It's not about Asian problems. But, you know, I've seen it that, you know, I studied Zen Buddhism with Japanese Zen masters. And, you know, I've seen it, you know, in there when they come to West and they wear their Asian robes and they obviously look like Japanese, you know, like Japanese people look, and when they come, so when Westerners, like people who listen to their lectures or join their retreats, you know, it's a special thing for these Westerners. You know, it's kind of, there's this Japanese man, you know, who looks really interesting and exotic and kind of somehow exciting, who comes over once a year and does black ink calligraphy and, you know, talks about ancient Zen masters. So I just like to go there because there's a nice atmosphere there. So, you know, or like Eckhart Tolle. I never joined Eckhart's live teachings, but I guess there must be people there also who kind of think that he's special. And one of the things why he might be seen special is because he stumbled upon his awakening. It happened by accident. It wasn't a result of practice. And there are, of course, people who wake up accidentally. I met a couple of those myself. But the point I'm getting to is that, you know, all beings, Buddhism says that all beings have Buddha nature. And, you know, there are methods and ways to get to know ourselves as wakeful beings rather than, you know, go round and round in these self-based mind states. So I think that's a really important point, that it's not about Asia, it's about us. Mm-hmm. It's not even about traditions, it's about us. Because like we have discussed, you know, not all traditions have, you know, in I say this with respect, but in my view, a lot of traditional practices are very irrelevant in terms of awakening. So, and you know, traditions, when somebody becomes a student of a traditional method, you know, the tradition starts educating that person, you know, kind of molds that person into the mold that the tradition has. But again, it might be a lot of that, or all of that might be irrelevant in terms of awakening, in terms of knowing ourselves as wakeful beings. So that's what I mean, that it's not even about tradition, it's about knowing ourselves in the deepest, most profound manner. I think that this is just a clear understanding of what Buddhism or Buddha Dharma is. So if somebody wants to read like quotes from Buddha or Muji at Muji evenings in a candlelight, you know, some nice, you know, beach waves, sound of beach waves in the background, that's perfectly fine. But, you know, that's not what made Muji, is it? So, or any other of these famous teachers. They all started with awakening, that experience.
Mm-hmm. And I totally agree about that. It's about the nature of mind, and one has to keep up an openness to discover it again and again and again, and to be open for techniques that make that easier. This is just a common sense thing to do, that when you aim to master something, that you look for the best techniques, that you look for the best ways how to do it. But there is, I think, in spiritual practices, this openness and this sincerity to coming back to this freshness of the natural state again and again is mistaken for stubbornness. And people become stubborn with practices they've been doing for years and years. Yeah. And in psychology, there's even this principle of sunk cost. It's a cognitive dissonance. If you invested years already, you are much less likely to let go of that practice because, no, I haven't wasted these years. So I keep doing what doesn't work just to not realize or not having to admit that I did something useless or not that useful in the aim that I'm actually pursuing.
Mm-hmm. And at the end, you get a diploma for carrying through it.
written on the gravestone. One hell of a practitioner. One thing has remained open, but it's not something to discuss deeply, but more as a general outlook. I think this is important towards the end as a stepping stone, that awakening also makes further spiritual practice much, much easier. It enables it to a certain degree in the first place. And so it's not a shift that, I mean, the shift in itself is amazing and it changes so much in long term. But if you leave it at that, you will be a much less suffering human being. This is for sure. If you don't practice anymore after awakening, this removes a mountain of suffering. But if you then keep going on the traditional path, not the traditional, I mean the non-dual path in general, and you want to practice and you want to follow the map along and you want to make that taste, this taste of awakening, you want to eat nothing else than that and you want to spread that into all realms of beings, that they also get to eat nothing but that. If you feel that sense of bodhicitta, of spreading the Dharma, awakening has a crucial effect on further practice. Is there something can say something about that?
Yeah, well, I would just say that without initial awakening, there's not going to be any consecutive awakenings leading to the full enlightenment, full awakening, full Buddhahood. So we mentioned earlier, it's the start of the path. So if you don't have initial awakening, you're not on the actual path. There, you might have some benefits from meditation for sure, and you might have glimpses, but you're not really doing what the Buddha instructed, what all spiritual traditions, authentic ones, what they actually instruct and what they teach towards. So to me, it says in our notes that does awakening make meditation and non-dual practice easier? And there is no non-dual practice without initial awakening.
Yeah. Something that I remembered when Ugi was just talking is that there was this very famous, probably the most famous Japanese Zen master of the last 500 years called Hakuin. And I forgot which ancient Chinese Zen master he was quoting, but you know, he and this ancient Chinese master were talking about 18 awakening experiences, not just one or two, but 18 of them. And so I think that I don't remember exactly the Hakuin's, you know, how he said it, but I think he said that he had 18 major breakthroughs and many, many small ones. So to have 18 major shifts, you have to start with the first one. And that it's a major shift. It's a breakthrough. It's an awakening rather than just a little taste on the tongue. That it's like that it changes your life. It's not like, I had this, you know, 2 weeks ago on Saturday evening, I was meditating and I had this, this experience. I had a glimpse, but then it's 2 weeks ago. No, that's not a major breakthrough. Major breakthrough is that you still have it after 2 weeks or after 2 years. And what Hakuin was talking about, Zen Master Hakuin, is that from that basic first awakening, you start, I'm holding my hands like this. So you start making the hole that you see through. You didn't have a hole before, but now you had an awakening. So there's a hole that you can see through. And then you start having further awakenings and that hole becomes bigger, bigger, bigger. And in Hakuin's words, assuming that he attained Buddhahood, you know, he says that he had 18 of those. So he had 18 pops until the whole collapsed. And nothing was left except wakefulness and clarity and softness and love and compassion and wisdom, rooted and grounded in everyday life. So maybe that's good to mention, that you have to start with the first one. And yeah, that's my view, that the sooner you can get there, the better. Usually people who come to spiritual practice and paths, they have had life experiences, you know, easy ones and difficult ones, good ones and bad ones. So that's, I think that's enough preparation. You know, why lengthen it when you can start removing this, removing the very cause that is making our lives difficult. Do that. Get awakened. And then again and again and again and again. I hope that this discussion has, you know, brought awakening nearer to people, you know, amongst people, rather than it would be somewhere in Asia or somewhere in Eckhart Tolle's possession, or, you know, whatever, that it belongs to people, because, you know, we have that potential. We just need to have ways to recognize that, ways to access that. And I hope that this little podcast benefits in that way.
I think that after we have been talking now, that's the main message, that for people who hasn't yet awakened, it can happen within 2020, to put it like that. There is no reason whatsoever that it shouldn't.
So thank you on my behalf.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, for tuning in. Next podcast will appear in a few weeks. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening.
If you would like to know more about the practice of Pemako Buddhism or the two-part formula to awakening, you can go to pemakobuddhism.com and get all the information and practice instructions for free. We also have a page and groups on Facebook where you can ask questions or get in contact with practitioners and teachers. All the links are right below in the description of this video. Cheers!